thank you guys all so much for joining this call. To any reporters on the line, thank you. I just want to remind everybody that this call is on the record and is being recorded, and I'll make sure to send around a transcript as soon as I have one. It usually takes about 24 hours or less. I would also like to remind everybody to please keep yourselves muted when you're not speaking, so we can avoid background noise and make sure that we get a really solid recording. All right, so just to get things started, we have Tom Wright, Constanza Stelzenmuller, Giovanna DeMau, and Amanda Sloat on the line here to talk about the coronavirus situation in Europe. They're each going to give a few brief opening remarks, and then we'll have the bulk of the call available for reporters. So we're going to go ahead and just kick things off with Tom Wright. So, Tom, whenever you're ready.
Great. Thanks so much, and it's great to be talking with everyone. So I'm just going to sort of talk for about 4 or 5 minutes and just make sort of 4 points on the European reaction, particularly the EU level. And Constanza, Amanda, and Giovanna will talk about the Germany, the UK, and Italy in their remarks. So the first point is really on the EU. The EU does not have public health in its sort of competency. It's not a core competency of the Union. And what we've seen basically so far is that almost all of the action in Europe is at the domestic national level, right? So countries are sort of dealing with this on their own. There's very little focus on the EU level, with one exception, which is unsurprisingly President Macron of France, who's asked for regular sort of teleconference calls at the European Council level and put those on the agenda. But if it wasn't for that, we'd be, I think, seeing very little action in terms of the public health sphere, because they're all dealing with major national crises that they're trying to focus on. So for them, I think the worry is, you know, partially the initial shock, but also the duration. This is a very different crisis if it's 4 to 6 weeks, or 4 or 6 months, or 6 to 10 months. And they're all sort of feeling that very acutely. In terms of how they're sort of dealing with it nationally, just the foreign affairs ministries, one official told me, have been turned into giant consular operations. So pretty much 90% of their effort is to try to get their citizens home from elsewhere in Europe. If you're a European, an EU citizen, you're entitled to health care if you have insurance in other EU countries. But in practice, that's not really manifesting itself, and that people want to get home to where they're from in case they get this or they have to hunker down. So there's actually discussions with other countries about rights of transit through Germany, for instance, which has its borders closed, and that's sort of where the diplomatic action is. The second point is just on these export controls that have been getting a fair amount of attention. I think it's helpful to sort of think about this in two sort of areas. One are the export controls by the EU as a whole, preventing the export of key medical equipment to third-party countries. And that, I think, is going to have a negative effect on some of those third countries. And it's also designed to try to create this European space where what they produce can be used internally. The second is, you know, the acquisition of some of this medical equipment by individual countries. The German case got a fair bit of attention on that. That was described to me by one official as sort of being misinterpreted, that their effort was to try to prevent the private sector or private business from acquiring many of these assets and then sort of arbitraging them and selling them at a higher rate later on. So there's a degree of nationalization, which is to have it in government hands as opposed to private sector hands. So I think that's a sort of an interesting distinction. The third point is just on the Eurozone. I think this is going to be the big sort of crisis in a couple of months or even before then, because we have the public health part of this, but the economic part is obviously enormous. Unemployment rates are rising very rapidly here and in Europe. No country in Europe has the capacity to deal with this economic shock on their own, with the possible exception of Germany, right? So every other country is basically going to go bust unless they get sort of European help. They're all going to blow through the different budgetary limits, the 3% limit that's been set down and by the Eurozone. So the big question is, can the Eurozone be adaptive? Some have called for Eurobonds, that mutual sort of debt instrument that Germany resisted. And Merkel made some sort of positive signs about that, but then sort of rolled some of that back pretty quickly. And maybe Constanze might be able to talk about more of this, but I think that's sort of the big fight, you know, 6, 8, 12 weeks down the road is, you know, will the Eurozone sort of reform or be adaptive, or how will they sort of deal with this? And that decision, I think, will largely rest in German hands rather than the rest of Europe. Germany's the only country that has a surplus. What's interesting about sort of that sort of financial part of the crisis is, unlike the euro crisis, there's no east-west divide or north-south divide. Everyone's sort of in it together, with the caveat that Germany's the only country that actually has a surplus to be able to deal with it sort of autonomously. And the final point is just on the U.S. There was a lot of attention here on the Trump travel ban to Europe. My sense is that this was not particularly controversial in Europe, and that if it was, it's not very controversial now, because everyone's been imposing pretty draconian travel restrictions. And the story about Trump trying to acquire this vaccine company, I think, was more controversial and disturbing. But for the most part, this is not really sort of a transatlantic or American story. They're not sort of worried about what Trump is doing. To the extent they think about the U.S., they think about the U.S. sort of bumbling its response, and that it's showing the limits of populism in terms of the approach to a major public health crisis. So I'll leave it there and turn it over to the next person. Thank you.
Thanks, Tom. Amanda, do you want to get started?
Sure. I can just flag a couple of things. One thing that I had been looking at and have a blog piece coming out imminently on is the impact that coronavirus is having on elections across Europe. Italy and Germany did end up going ahead with local elections in France and regional elections in Bavaria. In France, it caused some controversy since the country had increased to a stage 3 level of response the day before the elections, whereas in Germany, the more radical measures introduced by Merkel came the day after the Bavarian elections were being held. One interesting distinction is that France has decided to postpone the second round of local elections, whereas the decision in Bavaria has been to hold the second round via postal ballots. So unclear why Germany's taking that route and France is deciding to delay. Other elections also being postponed in Spain, in North Macedonia, in Serbia, in Northern Cyprus. The UK, interestingly, has been seen as a laggard in Europe in terms of its response to the crisis more generally, but was actually the first country to come out and decide to postpone local and mayoral elections in England. Those were expected to be held on May 7th. And actually last week on March 13th, the government came out to announce that decision. Second, related to the UK, as I mentioned, they have been seen somewhat as an outlier in Europe in terms of their response. I know many of you have already written stories on this, focusing much more on this idea of herd immunity and a phased quarantine. What I found interesting anecdotally talking to people is there initially seemed to be a degree of sympathy for the government's approach. People were somewhat able to explain the rationale for it, but then frustration started to build, and especially political pressure, as the UK was seen to be behind other countries in Europe, and we've now started to see a significant spread of the disease in the UK and the government adjusting its measures. I think the government always intended to impose some of those similar measures. They just had a slower and more phased approach in line with some of the behavioral science that they were relying on. One of the potential casualties for this in the UK seems to be the impact on Brexit. Michel Barnier came out earlier this week indicating that he has coronavirus, and there's now reports that the British Brexit negotiator, David Frost, is also in self-isolation with a sense that he has coronavirus as well. One of the big questions then is what ends up happening with negotiations and the transition periods. Boris Johnson, of course, had been very reluctant to extend the transition period, even writing into legislation that that was not possible. There has been some indication of a softening of his approach in the last day or two, with him now citing the legislative restriction, which, of course, Parliament could easily amend, but not ruling out the possibility of it. The UK has until the end of June to request the extension to the transition period, and that would have to be for either a 1 or 2 year time frame. The last thing just to flag on the UK is that there continues to be variation within how the different nations and regions within the UK are responding to this. Scotland has been out in front in some areas in terms of being quicker to put restrictions on mass gatherings. And you also saw tensions arising in Northern Ireland for a period of time when the British and Irish governments were taking different approaches to responding to the crisis. So I'll stop there.
Okay, thank you. Constanza, do you want to get started? Constanza, are you there? Giovanna, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Why don't you go ahead and get started?
Sure, yeah. So I was going to talk a little bit about the situation in Italy on the political, economic level and how this is going to impact international international relations. So as many of you know, Italy's death toll yesterday overtook China, and the situation is very tense. That's what I hear every day by talking to my family. Hotels are being converted into hospitals, and there are some companies and firms that are trying to convert their production protective medical gear. There will be more restrictive measures probably announced on March 25th around mobility with the possibility of employing the army to enforce them. So on the political level, as Tom Wright was saying early on, this crisis has really exposed the limits of populism. And in fact, the fascist movement basically placing the spectrum of left-wing populism has been proved to be setting aside all the European anti-EU grievances and has worked together with experts from the scientific community and healthcare system to tackle the crisis. The government has been really transparent in its measures, but there are also complaints about how long it took to actually implement the full lockdown. And as far as the nationalist positions, although in the beginning there was some uncertainty and some direct attacks against the government, now they've tried to be more cooperative but also more demanding towards the government and asking for more restrictive measures in order to try to stop these contagions and seems unstoppable, because people, despite the lockdown, are still going out in the streets and taking advantage of taking their walks, their dog for some walks, and also going to the grocery store and staying out longer than necessary. On the economic side, the damage is just uncountable. Today, a newspaper reported a contraction in oil consumption of -10%. It's the lowest since 1943. The government has issued €25 billion of deal for support to small and medium enterprises, to family, and of course to the healthcare system with the employment of nurses, doctors, and also calling back doctors who were retired in order to be able to help, especially in the red zone where the situation is extremely critical. On the economic side, there's also one last point on the golden power rules. So in order to prepare for what comes after this big crisis, the government has said that it's going to be employing using the so-called golden power, meaning that it can stop foreign direct investment in strategic sector in order to prevent Italy to be actually taken for Italy strategic tech sector to be taken over by foreign companies. So there is sort of protectionism kind of measure announced to be implemented soon. And lastly, on international relations, so Italy indeed has been turning to the EU for economic support, and I think there has been a huge load of understanding from the European Union perspective as far as quantitative easing announced by the European Central Bank in order to support Italy, but also like the Eurozone. But on the other hand, I believe for what I've understood by talking with diplomats and other Italian officials, there is a very big uncertainty and disappointment vis-a-vis the European Union and solidarity between member states. As Tom was mentioning earlier, embassies and diplomatic entities are trying to focus on bringing back people, repatriate people from abroad. And this is one of the priorities of that the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, Luigi Di Maio, announced yesterday. But of course, there has been the number one priority is securing medical gear, protective medical gear, especially face masks, and they will be coming this weekend from Turkey, Egypt, Germany, Brazil, and China, and there will be around 100 million masks coming from China next week. So Italy is turning to that, to like cooperation with other member states, non-European member states, but also scientific coordination with the United States on this level. So Italy is trying to engage bilaterally on this level without actually looking into European Union coordination and solidarity. So that's all I have for now.
Okay.
I'm back on the call.
Can you hear me?
Hi, everyone. Thanks for joining us on this call. On Germany, you will have noticed that we have a national medical institute called the Robert Koch Institute, which has been playing a central role in the information policy about this crisis. According to the RKI, as it's generally called, we are now at 11,000 cases and nearly 30 deaths as confirmed by labs. Johns Hopkins' comparative website has a much higher number because it uses different sources. It is probably useful going forward to use both those data sets if you're interested in doing the numbers. As for the policy responses, it will not have escaped your notice that Merkel gave a historic speech last week in which she appealed to German citizens' sense of responsibility, said the best expression of care towards each other is keeping your distance. It was an unusually warm and personal speech. She also said, I have difficulty just ordering a curfew or lockdowns because of my personal experience as an East German fighting for freedom for so much of my youth. And I think it's said that about 25 to 30 million Germans watched this. Has it had any effect? Not based on the numbers of people who are still out in parks and playgrounds and apparently doing something called Corona parties, which is apparently so that people will infect each other and get it over with, not a wise course of action. But it was also clear to everybody who saw that speech that it was a potential step for further escalation towards a national lockdown. And in fact, the Bavarian government has already taken this step. As you probably know, Bavaria is the state that's closest to Italy. A lot of Bavarians go to Italy on their skiing holidays, and it is the state with the highest number of cases. And after a number of municipalities went on lockdown this week, the minister president Markus Söder ordered a complete lockdown today, and other state minister presidents are expected to follow. The issues before the German government now, I think, are three. One is using economic stimulus and other tools at its command to prevent a mass joblessness, a crash of the German economy. As Tom said accurately, we should have the resources to do that. Still, it's a historic task, and that is why the German finance and economics minister this week spoke of pulling out the bazooka. The second big issue is emergency supplies and making sure the medical system works. There, Germany is at the top of the list of the European countries in terms of ICU beds at about 25,000 to 28,000. It's still not clear that that will be enough at current infection rates. The numbers that I cited earlier show the Germans pretty precisely tracking the Italian development. So there will have to be emergency production in that sector as well. And I think the medical services are expecting to be overwhelmed as everywhere else. And I think the third issue that might become one, we're not seeing it yet, is simply keeping public order. This will be a test of German social cohesion. And we will see how state authority responds to that. Meanwhile, many other things that were keeping me busy, and I'm sure some of you, appear to be on hold. One is, of course, the political succession question in the CDU and the succession for Merkel herself. You will have heard that one of the three candidates to succeed her, Friedrich Merz, has tested positive for corona and is in isolation. The party meeting that was supposed to decide on the candidature in late April has been put on hold, with no new date. The other question that's on hold, at least partially, is how to deal with the truly ghastly refugee crisis still playing out in the Greek camps. Tom referenced the fact that Europe right now is as a community of solidarity seems to be put more or less on hold. I agree with him completely that much of this will play out in managing the Eurozone crisis to come. But if we cannot manage the health crisis that we're all facing and the refugee crisis, I think that will have a similarly damaging impact on European cohesion. And finally, sort of one German topic is the ongoing battle between the establishment politics and the populists. And it seems it's been noted that the German far-right party, the AfD, appears to be floundering at this point, and engaged in infighting, engaged in basically it appears to be in something of a meltdown. I can't say that that wouldn't please me. I'll stop here.
Okay. Thank you, Constanza, and thank you to all four of you for your insight. We will go ahead and open it up to Q&A. So if there are any reporters on the line who want to ask a question, now's the time. Please just do introduce yourselves and say which outlet you're from before you ask your question. Thank you.
Yes, this is George Kahn.
Hi, True.
With National Journal. I just wanted, in all the planning for pandemics, all the exercises and so on, there was always an assumption that there would be American leadership, economic and medical. That doesn't seem to be playing out. What is the reaction in Europe to whether there's leadership being provided from Washington?
It's Tom here. I can jump in first. I mean, I think they're also focused on the domestic element, but they're not really, directly sort of criticizing the lack of leadership. But I think it's acutely felt at the governmental level. So There's just been really no leadership response from the U.S. at all. A few weeks ago, there was a ministerial meeting of the G20 in Saudi Arabia, and the U.S. delegation, I'm told, was basically wanting to say that everything's fine because they didn't want to. They were in there not being sort of forthright phase of the Trump administration's approach. And then we didn't see sort of any effort at the G7 or G20 level. The G7 call, which I think was helpful in the communique out of it, which was rather pretty positive, that was sort of Macron's idea. So he suggested and then suggested the U.S. hold the call as sort of the chair of the G7. And so that was a good way of getting Trump's buy-in. I'm told that Trump was sort of skeptical of that, but I'm not sure, don't have that totally confirmed. But it came out sort of relatively in the right place, and the Fed is, doing more now as well. But we're still seeing a huge sort of difference between what's being provided and what's required because, the economic side of this, I think, is really the big piece where you could have U.S. leadership to try to have a coordinated stimulus and also measures to save the financial system if it becomes apparent, as it may very well do over the next 2 or 3 months, that there are various sort of financial issues as a result of the massive economic slowdown.
Okay, next question.
Hi, it's Trudy Rubin from the Philadelphia Inquirer. I'm wondering how the testing issue is playing out in Europe. Is there any country that seems to have a testing regimen, remotely resembling South Korea's? And is testing seen as key in Europe?
Absolutely. I don't think that I think that all countries are scrambling to increase testing and to make it more broadly available, but that's also a function of the quality of medical services and the ability of public authorities, local and regional, to provide the infrastructure. And I think it's true for many of us, including rich Germany, that we have disinvested. We've ruthlessly, basically stripped out the fat from hospitals and public health services, turning them into lean profit machines. And I think we're paying the price for that now. So no, we're not at that point yet.
Can I jump in on this?
Sure.
Please.
Yeah.
Sure.
So Italy has been pretty active in providing tests for everybody, but now what I hear from my friends who are doctors in the red zones, they're telling me that the tests are only available for those who actually experience breathing issues. So they're deciding not to test so many people because it's not just a matter of shortage of actual test kits, but also it takes time for the labs to actually analyze them. And so there is a big shortage, as Costante was saying, also of facilities, and probably as in Germany, as it happened in Germany, Italy has been disinvesting from the public sector, from the public healthcare sector since 2008 with all the austerity measures and the crunches that public sector experienced. But also this crisis highlighted how important it is to have coordination and standards that are the same on the national level, because regions in Italy have been currently have some degree of autonomy in how to deal with public health, and this has created a lot of discrepancies in how this corona emergency has been actually dealt with. In the Veneto region, that's actually a virtuous example. Basically, in Veneto, they've been testing everybody, and this has led to a more efficient isolation of those who did not show symptoms. And so this has allowed to slow down significantly the contagion.
Well, just one further thing on China. China is now shipping aid to Europe and to Italy. At this point, how is the
Chinese model regarded in Europe, especially since they're pushing the propaganda line that they can handle it better than others, despite the beginning of the debacle in Wuhan. And how are there comparisons being made with the United States?
I can start answering that. So the narrative now, you're right, it's very much loaded with Chinese but also Russian propaganda and fake news coming through the internet. Now China, yes, is viewed not just, I think, a little bit in opposition to what's happening in France, I think, where people are talking about how the Chinese have been hiding the spread of the virus since the end of November. But in Italy, now China is viewed as the savior because China has been sending doctors and sending face masks, whereas European member states have been kind of adopting a more protectionist approach, especially vis-a-vis medical equipment. There has been said, and the news about Wuhan not having having completely stopped the contagion yesterday, it's been talked, has been reported by Italian officials saying basically that if China made it, Italy can do it too. And Italy is actually applying the China model in terms of restrictions and preventing people from moving around, although it's doing it the Italian way. So, of course, the enforcement is not yet comparable to Chinese level. But indeed, it's a trend worth watching for the next, especially as we proceed, as not only the pandemic goes on, but also the economic crisis impacts Italy. It's definitely now a significant narrative around how China has been more helpful. As far as the United States, what I've heard mostly is from the diplomatic team here, they're trying to engage the United States more, especially on scientific coordination for trying to work on the vaccine, and especially looking at Italy wants U.S. to look at Italy as, you know, the first lab of COVID-19 in Europe, and so how we can put forces together and implement scientific coordination in this, cooperation in this.
May I jump in here to answer Trudy's question as far as Germany is concerned?
Of course.
Please.
I've just pulled up a story in Der Spiegel, Trudy, that if you want, I can also give you more details on offline. But basically, the German response is different from that in South Korea on testing. You can get tested only if you see a doctor and the doctor decides, based on the criteria developed by the Robert Koch Institute, that there is a medical indication of need for a test. So in other words, you can't just march in to a hospital and say, I want to be tested because my throat is feeling scratchy. There have been apparently, says the Association of Doctors, more than 100,000 corona test last week conducted in doctors' offices. We have clearly been ramping up capacity. The Robert Koch Institute says that lab capacity is at 160K tests per week, and there are 47 labs in Germany that offer it, and by now there are also so-called drive-in test centers. But it's still probably below the capacity of what is going to be necessary. Okay?
Hi, this is Amanda. Just on the China question, I'm going to promote a rival think tank here. But the Alliance for Security and Democracy at the German Marshall Fund has actually done some really interesting work on how China is promoting itself in Europe. Jessica Brandt had a Twitter thread yesterday that outlined this. They looked at almost 3,000 tweets from China's diplomatic and state media and found that a lot of engagement was coming from Chinese embassies in France, Italy, and Spain, and all of them are highlighting assistance from China. And so they're really trying to position themselves as a provider of public goods. They're making a lot of the lack of U.S. leadership on this, and they're also suggesting that the U.S. leadership isn't just feckless, but it's actually xenophobic.
It's just that Tom here, just weigh in too. I mean, I think it's really hard to say exactly what the European reaction is, because we don't have sort of the time that's lapsed or polls that say that there's a, you know, public support for this, or that they sort of buy the Chinese line. We know that China is pushing this line, but we don't really know how it's been received. I've tried to talk to a number of European officials over the last week, and I have to say that they were all pretty realistic in terms of what China is up to. They knew what they were trying to do. They also were, you know, very aware of the line that China was pushing, that this virus actually came from the U.S. originally, which they all thought was outrageous. And they recognized that China made very serious mistakes early on. So I think what we're seeing is a concerted Chinese effort to try to erase that past. We don't know whether or not it was successful or not. We have two sort of data points. One is a Serbian president saying this very positive thing about China because of the export controls imposed by the EU. And then we have the Italian sort of case as well, as Giovanna outlined, where there was some welcoming of the masks and other, you know, supplies being imported into Italy from China. But apart from that, we don't really have, I think, a lot of sort of evidence that, you know, that this sort of Chinese plan is working. And I think we won't really know for a couple of months. But it does underscore that the U.S. should be, I think, providing more sort of leadership and working more closely with its allies.
Let me perhaps add on the question of U.S. leadership, since two of you have asked this. And certainly for my country, Germany, the German-American relationship on the official level was already pretty bad. And German diplomacy had adapted to basically working around Trump. In other words, working with the rational elements of the NSC, the White House, the federal executive, and I think increasingly paying attention to relationships at state and local level. There are a lot of German economic and indeed academic investments in America that don't need to be managed via the White House. That said, I suspect the CureVac story, the story about Trump attempting to buy proprietary rights over the vaccine being developed in this lab in the German city of Tübingen, presumably, at least from what I can see on social media, did a great deal of harm. And it's notable that it was confirmed by the German health minister, who is, if any member of the Trump cabinet, of the Merkel cabinet, has attempted to stay on the good side of the Trump administration, it's the German health minister, Jens Spahn. That struck me as a notable blow to the German-American relationship. But you know, at this point, frankly, we're all in crisis management mode, and this stuff is only, you know, it's going to be a blip on the screen, and arguably already is.
I have a question. This is Rachel Oswald, reporter with CQ Roll Call. Along those lines of vaccines, antivirals, what type of, and if it's not, what type of mechanism do you think there should be for coordinating how the international community will respond when a vaccine or antiviral is ready? Will there be some kind of prepared, shared, common guidelines that say we give it to the most vulnerable first, you know, or we will subsidize the cost of vaccines? And would the body to kind of come up with such guidelines be the UN, the G20? Like, what is the thinking on doing that now rather than once there's actually a vaccine ready and everybody wants it immediately?
Well, in normal times, that would be the World Health Organization, the WHO.
Yes, and I'm here. I mean, what I've sort of heard, I've asked about this again to different, you know, officials, and what they say they would like to see is, you know, G20 maybe coordinated action, or through the UN to ensure that when the vaccine sort of does emerge, that it's, it can be scaled sort of quickly and then dispersed to everyone, you know, irrespective of sort of their wealth or position, both within countries and around the world. So I think getting that vaccine out will require a level of diplomatic coordination, that's, you know, an enormous level of diplomatic coordination. I think the World Health Organization has a sort of part to, you know, to play in that, although I would note that, you know, I don't think that will be sort of enough because there are, you know, different, you know, the U.S. I think has sort of a different attitude maybe toward the WHO than some other countries do, and there are questions about, you know, China's role in the WHO as well that sort of date back to how it handled sort of early parts of this crisis, particularly at the leadership level. But I would say, you know, just along the lines that Cassandra said, you know, most of those organizations you mentioned would have a role to play, but it has to be sort of spearheaded by, I think, the G20 countries to, you know, to come up with sort of a workable, you know, plan for everyone. And what Trump was sort of accused of doing in Germany, of course, is exactly opposite to that, to say that you could have a more of a America-first or country-first approach to the development of the vaccine.
Daniel Frank from The Economist. I wonder, perhaps this one for Tom, whether this so far the crisis has been revealing in any senses for you for on the European Union and what it shows about the European Union that may not have been apparent before. For example, it seems that, you know, when push comes to shove, Schengen ceases to exist almost. And in these circumstances anyway, the instinctive answer is more country rather than more Europe, which is usually the European sort of a formal response. What has it shown so far for you?
Yeah, it's Tom here. I can start on that. I mean, I think it shows that the states still really matter, you know, like exactly on your question. I mean, it's more important, I think, at the moment where what country people are from in Europe than that they are sort of EU citizens, you know, because the response has been so national. Now, I think where the EU, you know, has a real role to play, you know, is on the economic part of that, but that's going to require major sort of changes and reforms to the Eurozone, you know, in particular. You know, I think that debate, you know, has yet to happen, really. There are certain, you know, in the middle, at the height of a crisis, people make certain conciliatory noises, but there's a big sort of question whether or not that will be sustained and go into sort of real agreed positions on some of these, you know, limits on budgets and the, you know, and the like. But I think it's going to be a huge test for the EU. I think the reason, though, we're seeing this more national response, I think it's important to underscore, is that health has never been sort of a key competency of the Union. So it's not that the EU is sort of failing on this, right? This is not like a monetary question or even a fiscal question where you could say, you know, that they were meant to deal with this. This is something that's basically outside of what the EU really deals with. So it's not really a surprise that it's more of a national response, but it's still very striking.
May I come in? This is Constanza.
Please.
Hello, Daniel. Just to come in on to add to what Tom just said, the domestic policy and health has always been a national competence. And what this is a test of the nation state in Europe. Now, I think that one of the myths that you hear in Washington particularly, but also in London, is they have this notion of the EU as a federalizing superstate. That never happened. And in fact, if anything, we've seen for the last 10, 15 years a counter-movement, a restoration of the nation state into what some would have said is its proper state or its proper position as the first responder. And the leader of that movement, as Daniel, I'm sure you know, was Angela Merkel with her famous Bruges speech. And so, to me, the irony here is that the question that we need to ask ourselves, are our nation states truly capable of doing these things, particularly when the challenge that they're supposed to address is one that transcends borders with ease, and where political coordination, if you have made a decision that this shouldn't be a competence of the EU, then this is a matter of political coordination between the nation states and between capitals. And based on what I was reading this morning in Florian Eder's reports about recent COREPER meetings, apparently that's not going so well. So I think the irony here might be that we end up saying, well, actually, we're going to have some structures here that are a little more formal than just ambassadorial meetings, because we're going to have to coordinate across borders. And that will have a direct impact on how other things that are EU competences, like the economic situation, will progress in the very near future.
Okay, thank you. We just have a few more minutes left for any final questions.
If I can ask another one, or if someone hasn't asked one,
let's
go
see
ahead.
If there's anybody else with another question, and if not,
This is Dave Waller from Axios. Thanks everyone for doing the call. I have a question for Giovanna about the political situation in Italy. There's been, you know, some rumblings about the far right potentially taking advantage of resentment toward Europe for a lack of solidarity towards the EU in particular, I guess. But also, obviously, we've all been writing about the instability of this government prior to this crisis. I'm just wondering, you know, it's early days, but what the outlook at present is on all of that.
Thank you for your question. So at the moment, as Amanda mentioned earlier, regional elections are now like probably on hold, so they're not going to be held in April. So usually regional elections have already proved that already in January, when Italy voted in when Italians voted in Emilia and Umbria and in Calabria, that the League and the far right was in general very strong and gaining momentum. So now with regional elections on hold, it's really hard to tell, because I feel there is in general a sense between the Italians of like great support, probably an effect of rallying behind the flag of Conte's deal of the crisis. Salvini has been particularly active. Salvini is the leader of the League. He's been particularly active in the beginning in the critique of the government and the European Union, and still he pulses a few tweets per day in which he criticizes the European Union and the lack of solidarity on the masks, on the medical equipment level. But now he has stopped, and he has focused mostly on implementing further restrictions. So, like, you can see them more on the authoritarian spectrum. So my sense is that for now, Italians are well behind Conte and support of the current government. But it would be really, really the challenge of when the virus is gone, hopefully sooner than later, see how the economy will be impacted and if all these measures are actually able to support and to protect families and small and medium enterprises that have been facing this huge crisis.
Yeah, same for Germany, I think.
Can I get one more in?
Sure.
I'm just wondering, even though it's early on and everyone is in the midst of the crisis, are there people in Europe, either at a national or at an EU level, who are already doing projections of how long the economy or economies can sustain this shutdown without some kind of collapse?
Yeah, it's Tom here. I mean, I think the answer to that is they're working on that at the moment, but I don't think they've reached a sort of view or even a consensus on how long they would have. I think the big sort of thing that really worries them is, as I was saying earlier on, the duration. You know, they are sort of, you know, aware that this could go on and off for a year. You know, so if it's a W-shaped recession, you know, it's very severe and bounces back a little and then goes down again. You know, I think that's
or an L-shaped recession. I think that those are their sort of worst case scenario. So I think they're, you know, they're trying to get through the initial sort of peak and have a leveling off, and then have some sort of, I think then you'll see the real, you know, economic diplomacy, and most of this, you know, will occur at the sort of Eurozone level, because that's, you know, that's where the real constraints are. But I think I don't think they'll be able to get through the, you know, the summer without some major sort of changes at the in terms of the Eurozone constraints.
Thanks.
All right. Are there any final questions? We could maybe squeeze in one more.
Well, yeah, actually, this is George Condon again, if I could. You talked about the propaganda against the United States, the view on President Trump, the Chinese, looking down the road, is there likely to be long-term damage to the notion of the United States as the one you turn to, the leader of the alliance, or is this likely to be just transitory?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's partly, you know, it's partly wrapped up in Trump, you know, in that they do sort of, you know, they had low expectations of him, so it's not as if they had, you know, expected him to have a major sort of leadership role. And I think if he, you know, is defeated in November and you see an administration that's more sort of committed to that cooperation part, I think, you know, they won't sort of, they won't say, well, we don't believe you now, or, you know, we're not willing to sort of take this, because ultimately, you know, there's a desperate sort of need for that leadership, and they don't believe that can come from China, you know, notwithstanding the various sort of symbolic gestures from Beijing. I also think that what happens next is more important than what happened before, right? So all of the sort of hullabaloo over the travel ban and all of that, I think none of that really matters all that much, because all of them now have travel bans and no one's really, you know, traveling anyway at that time. The real question is when you get to, you know, the global economic response, and when you have, you know, needs for, you know, assistance and help and coordination in the next sort of 6 to 8 months, does the U.S. do things that, and do other countries do things that are sort of counterproductive and more along the lines of Smoot-Hawley rather than the response in 2008-09. And that, I think, will be sort of held against, you know, the perpetrators of that, whether it's the U.S. or any other country, for quite a while. So that's sort of what I would be, you know, what I would be looking at. I don't think, you know, I think there's been a real sort of failure of U.S. leadership so far, but I don't think it's sort of irreparable to the to sort of the U.S. reputation yet.
I would agree with that. I think that, you know, there is a lot of room now for doing what's necessary for all of us. And by the way, I mean, there is a similar question for German leadership in Europe. And over the last two weeks, the German government has self-corrected on a number of things that you were damaging to its role as the largest economy in Europe, as one of the putative two or three leaders, such as its refusal to export medical instruments, like masks and respirators. Thank God it is not now doing that, but it took them 2 weeks. So you're not alone.
I would just third what both of them said. I mean, I think for Europeans, they've gotten very used to Trump's America First approach over the last 3 years. Yeah. And so this is simply an additional data point in terms of how the U.S. is responding. Given that there's now been a pretty significant shift in Trump's attitude toward the crisis, having gone from suggesting it was a hoax to now recognizing it's something he needs to take more seriously, I think Tom is right that the question is going to be how he ends up responding now in the next couple of months going forward.
All right. Thank you all so much. If there are no final questions, we will go ahead and end the call here. I want to thank everybody for joining, and especially our four scholars for taking the time to speak with us today. As I mentioned earlier, we will have a transcript, and I will make sure to send that around to all of you just as soon as I have it. It shouldn't take more than 24 hours, and hopefully it will be much less, so I will let you guys know.